From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a fight over the First Amendment at Harvard. This week, at a Harvard Law School town hall meeting, students called for the adoption of an anti-harassment code. In part, it appears, a speech code. Supporters want the code in response to racially charged incidents that rocked the law school last spring. Critics call it an affront to free speech. This hour, On Point, the First Amendment on campus, can both speech and students be protected? We begin with a promising development on the medical front. A report out today in the New England Journal of Medicine says scientists have successfully tested a vaccine against a virus that causes cervical cancer. Dr. Kevin Ault is an obstetrician and gynecologist at the University of Iowa and one of the authors of the report. I asked him to explain the science behind the effusive headlines.
Well, frequently, I'm a gynecologist and I see patients, so frequently I tell my patients nothing in medicine is 100%, but I've noticed a lot of the headlines have picked up on the fact that the way we did the study and the way we defined HPV infection, it did look like we had 100% efficacy. So it's a very exciting preliminary finding.
How big a problem is cervical cancer?
For the United States, cervical cancer is 10 or 12,000 cases a year, and unfortunately about half of those women aren't getting pap smears. So there are issues there. But also, again, speaking as a gynecologist, we spend a lot of time dealing with mildly abnormal pap smears, doing biopsies and having office visits to try to find people that really have precancerous changes to treat. And so in the United States healthcare system, we spend a lot of resources on those types of things. And if this vaccine works as well in the future as it appears in this preliminary trial, hopefully we'll be doing a lot less of that.
So maybe 12 or 13,000 cases a year in the U.S. We read about 4,000 deaths a year and maybe a quarter million deaths globally. So there's a big impact.
Globally is certainly the most exciting part of the issue. And you don't really have to go very far to be globally. South America has a horrible problem with cervical cancer. It would be one of the leading causes of cancer death in women in South and Central America.
Now, the headlines say vaccine for cancer, but in fact, it's a vaccine aimed at a viral infection, the human papillomavirus, that precedes cervical cancer. Can you draw the picture of how these three things relate, the virus, the cancer, and the vaccine?
Well, human papillomavirus is an incredibly common sexually transmitted infection. And you may have read that we think about 20% of American women are infected with this virus. And certainly a lot of them are getting new infections, and some people are clearing that up.
And maybe half of all women at some time during their lives would have it.
Maybe more. So certainly a very high number.
So here's a sexually transmitted virus. What does it do? How does it lead to cancer?
It's a very small genome as far as being a small virus, but it certainly causes a lot of problems. It has two genes in specifically that cause abnormal growth of cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so if those two gene products take over the neighborhood, then you have proliferation and cancer in the cervix. So that's how that leads to that. The vaccine, to try to link all three of them together, the vaccine is the product of one of the genes of human papillomavirus. It's actually the coat or the covering. And so the vaccine is a protein that is actually part of the natural virus. There's no live virus in the vaccine that we tested, but just the coat protein.
So if a woman were vaccinated against the human papillomavirus, she wouldn't get the virus, and then the odds of getting cervical cancer decline by a considerable degree?
That's certainly what we hope will be the future of this vaccine. The vaccine we tested, as you alluded to, just contained one type of human papillomavirus, human papillomavirus 16 or HPV 16.
But the most common type.
The most common type, and the one that's associated with about half of cervical cancers. There's a nice editorial from Dr. Krem that goes along with our article in the New England Journal of Medicine, and he mentions if you throw four or five more types or six types into a vaccine, you get up to very good protection. You know, 80 and 90% of cervical cancers would be caused by just a few types of HPV. to go back to what we were talking about a minute ago, the reason that this becomes a cancer vaccine is because of the very strong correlation of practically 100% of cervical cancers containing human papillomavirus and being the result of human papillomavirus infection.
Dr. Ott, we read of a separate study that came out recently which had been looking at an experimental vaccine against genital herpes and protected most women against getting that virus, although not necessarily men. But is it possible that we might someday, some year soon, see women, young women, I guess, before they would be sexually active, hypothetically, getting a double vaccination, one for human papillomavirus, one for genital herpes, that would lead to lifelong improved health?
We certainly would think that that might be the future. And that looks very promising. You know, the burden of herpes is the painful recurrent lesions that people get. And then, once again, speaking as obstetrician gynecologist, there are several thousand cases of neonatal newborn infection with herpes, and those can be quite devastating.
We know you're a doctor and a gynecologist, not a political scientist, but these diseases, as described here, do relate to behavior and sexual behavior. Do you imagine there's a political buzzsaw waiting out there for you? I mean, a young woman with these vaccinations would be, I guess, more free to be sexually active with less repercussion than another young woman. Is this going to run into political opposition, religious opposition?
Well, again, stepping away from the mantle of being a gynecologist, I have two young daughters at home, so I can make it even more personal than that.
Yes.
I have a 6-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you have to turn back the clock too much in America, just a couple of generations, to where cervical cancer was a killer, you know, in the 40s, in the 50s. So if people go home and talk to their grandmothers, they'll know that, like my grandmother knew, that cervical cancer was a death sentence when she was a young woman. There wasn't treatment available, and it was quite common back in the middle part of the last century. So to spare my daughters from that fear, I think that it would be worth it. And so I think that's the way that we would need to approach the public. People in healthcare would need to approach the public with this type of thing.
Well, it's a remarkable breakthrough, and we congratulate you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Kevin Ott is an obstetrician and gynecologist at the University of Iowa and one of the authors of the Cancer Vaccine Report appearing in today's New England Journal of Medicine. He spoke with me from Iowa City, Iowa. This week, representatives of the Black Law Students Association at Harvard Law School called for the school to adopt an anti-harassment code. In a bare-knuckles debate brimming with Harvard Law's trademark-style intellectual combat, students insisted that the law school needs a code to set a standard of what is and is not acceptable. Critics called the code nothing short of censorship, but last spring, a student used the word nig on a class website. A professor said blacks plus feminists and Marxists had contributed nothing to tort law, fighting words at Harvard Law, and a fight that other campuses have known as well. Now, an intense debate over where to draw the line on offensive speech is raging at the same school whose alumni nurtured the full flowering of free speech in America. Listeners, is America's marketplace of ideas a totally free market? Should any speech go on campus or in the classroom? Should a university place any restrictions on freedom of expression, on offensive, even harassing expression? And is it possible to protect both people and speech on American campuses? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight are three students from Harvard Law School. Joshua Bloodworth is a third-year student and president of the Black Law Students Association, the group that called for the anti-harassment policy. Good evening and welcome, Joshua Bloodworth.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Aaron Katz is in his second year, a member of the Committee on Healthy Diversity, and we'll find out what that is, and a member of the Harvard Law Review. Good evening and welcome, Aaron Katz.
Thanks.
And Nils Peterson is also in his second year and a member of the Executive Board of the Harvard Federalist Society. Welcome, Nils Peterson.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We'll also be joined later in the hour by Joy Cheney, a third-year student and founding member of the American Constitution Society, Harvard's chapter. So here we are. There's been quite a ruckus, and you felt the glare of the media spotlight this week after a little debate within the Ivy Walls. Now it's all over the place. I guess this grew out of incidents last spring that people were upset about. And, Josh, let me turn to you. Out of concern over what had happened in a few incidents last spring and perhaps a larger environment that we may not be aware of that you might describe to us, a harassment code
at the very least, has been proposed. It's been interpreted in some quarters and very widely in the media as a speech code. What's going on here?
Well, I would agree with you that it was not just events from last spring. As we contacted our alumni from 5 years ago and 10 years ago, the events that happened last spring or ones very similar to them have been recurrently happening at Harvard.
Define that problem for us.
Well, the problem is just a situation of intolerance by students and faculty feeling that it's okay to harass people or calling to their race, their gender, their religion, and the likes.
We don't think of Harvard Law School as a setting where students and professors set out to go around harassing each other. How does this come to be?
I can't tell you how it comes to be. I mean, Harvard Law School is a part of larger American society, and we do know that there is a problem with discrimination and harassment in the society, and I think you just see the same problems replicated. Now, what is good about Harvard Law School is that it is somewhat of a small community, so it has the chance now to actually mount an effective response to this type of harassment and this type of behavior.
A lot of the harassment you're talking about has to do with words.
I would say a lot of the harassment that I'm talking about have a speech component in addition to a conduct component.
Give us an example.
An example was last year on April 2nd, someone stuffed the Hark boxes. Those are the boxes that everyone at the school.
Mailboxes.
Mm-hmm. With a flyer that contained hate speech, swastikas, and the likes. That, to me, the actual act of passing out hate speech that has swastikas, actually very insulting to Jewish members of society. Yeah, it contains speech. Words are speech. Mm-hmm. But it was also a conduct that should be at least reviewed by Harvard to see if it's something that they want to take disciplinary action towards.
And the code that's being proposed would do what? Would draw lines where? How?
We don't have the – BALSA did not come up with a specific policy because we were invited to a town hall meeting where it said, please come share your thoughts and concerns. So we shared our thoughts and concerns, and we felt that any policy should definitely not just be limited to race, but should also take into account sexual orientation, national origins, religion, and that it definitely should look for conduct, and that severe or pervasive conduct harassment should trigger at least a review of the person who's doing that activity.
But when you got to the town hall meeting, the speech component was front and center, at least as we understand what went on there. Aaron Katz, what was the pushback on the notion of addressing, of drawing some boundaries around speech, even very offensive speech, at Harvard Law? What was the pushback?
Well, you know, I think on the first thing, any sort of code that they're proposing or policy is going to sort of be more sweeping than the First Amendment. Otherwise, there'd be no need for a policy.
By definition.
By definition, harassment would just simply be, you know, illegal because, you know, Massachusetts makes it illegal. But I think that, you know, what we're worried about is chilling speech that the policy or the code would not want reviewed or would not want to bar. But it's really the students' perceptions about what the policy or the code would do. So, for instance, stuffing the Hark mailboxes with the swastika last year. On the one hand, some people would say that surely falls within a harassment policy. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, that was actually a political statement saying that the school may react to anti-Semitic speech in a way different from anti-black speech.
Oh, so it was to raise consciousness of different kinds of harassment, I guess.
Well,
it was a kind of political theater, you're saying.
I think that was one of the intents, maybe the primary intent. Now, he might have gone about it in a silly fashion. He could have done it better, but he felt like that was the best way for him, so why would you want a policy?
So can a school like Harvard Law, with such a long tradition of devotion to free speech, have a harassment code, which Josh Bloodworth is describing why you might want one? Can it have one when speech is so often a component of harassment? Can it have such a code without prescribing the First Amendment, limiting the First Amendment, limiting fundamental constitutional guarantee of free speech?
Well, I think one thing we have to look at is whether the First Amendment, as interpreted currently by the Supreme Court, has some sort of normative value. There's an argument that harassing speech actually restricts speech on campus because it silences certain groups. If that's the case, then, you know, we need to take that position, not that we want to actually minimize speech altogether.
We're talking tonight about free speech on campus, about a Harvard Law School example. Can we protect speech and people simultaneously? Should all speech be protected, be free speech at a university? And if it's a marketplace of ideas, should anything go? You can join us and the Harvard Law School students with me tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about free speech on campus and a Harvard Law School example. It could happen anywhere. Can we protect speech and people? If it is a marketplace of ideas in this country, should anything go? Or should students have a list of words, of phrases they cannot say? And if Harvard Law School can't figure out the boundaries of free speech, where does that leave the rest of us? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by three Harvard Law School students, Joshua Bloodworth, Aaron Katz, and Nels Peterson. Nels, I want to bring you in here. Harvard Law has quite a distinguished record of alums, some very prominent ones who have spoken up very prominently for free speech. Oliver Wendell Holmes, class of 1867, the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, and the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market. That sounds like a pretty laissez-faire approach. It's one citation out of perhaps many. But how do you see this? Can we have free speech? Can we have no-holds-barred debate, the kind Harvard is famous for in its law school, and yet have boundaries that protect, that guard the dignity, and maybe more than that, of students?
I think we can. I think the concept of the marketplace of ideas is a very important one. And I think we saw that really exemplified in many ways based on the actions of this past year. There were a number of very unfortunate and offensive incidents both in and out of class, and there was massive student protests. There were a lot of articles written in the student newspaper uniformly condemning the actions.
There was the swastika in the mailboxes. There was this word "nig" in a class website or discussion room. There was a professor saying that feminists and black studies and Marxism have contributed nothing to tort law, which sounds, you know, kind of ethereal to most of us, but perhaps in the Harvard Law School realm, that's very offensive. Other things to help us understand?
There were several other. There was an additional anonymous email that was sent that was very offensive, aimed towards African Americans. There was another incident in a classroom involving a professor. I can definitely see how that would be offensive. And I was in the class where the professor said that blacks and feminists and Marxists hadn't contributed anything to tort law.
So what's going on here? Do you have raging racism, sexism at Harvard Law School? Or are these things at the margins of conversation that ordinary society would think of as just a rough edge but not a vital offense?
Harvard Law School obviously – racism is an issue that is a problem in our world, and obviously that's going to be reflected in Harvard Law School because Harvard Law School is a part of our world. But I think we've got, you know, a number of discrete examples. Two students out of 1,600 contributed to these issues, I think that to pass a sweeping speech code based on the actions of two very ignorant students would be nothing but allowing civilized society to really be held hostage by the lowest common denominator.
So you say no speech component to a harassment code, please.
That's right.
Josh Bloodworth, pick it up. Here it is. People are saying free speech is fundamental to the Constitution, to a law school, to this law school. Yes, wrong was done, but if we turn our speech boundaries inside out, if we create boundaries because of that, we're making ourselves hostage to the lowest common denominator.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I do want to point out that the professor didn't say black studies, but the blacks. He said blacks as a group had never contributed.
Sorry, I was quoting from the paper, but that's a little rougher.
And when it was brought to his attention two times, he continued to say the blacks have contributed nothing to the law. And then later on, he changed to say, oh, I meant critical studies. But at no point did anyone say that his speech would be covered by a harassment policy because it's in class. He has the right to express what he wants. He was expressing an opinion.
So where would the boundary fall?
I think one of the way the boundaries would fall is that you have to take speech and conduct together. I think there's a very famous example from the Supreme Court. I'm not exactly sure who said it, but they say you cannot stand up in a crowded theater and yell fire because you are creating danger. That's what we're saying, that because that is not just speech, that's conduct. And just like women have been telling us forever, you can't say someone going around and saying lewd and crude things about women using certain words anytime is just fine because it creates a environment in which physical danger does come. But we shouldn't only be concerned about the physical danger, but the emotional damage that it does. We're saying that there are other other areas of life, and we've identified some, that work like gender and can create real harassment and danger, intimidation, and harm.
So who couldn't understand that in a diverse society with a history of plenty of harm, stretching back as far as you want to go? On the other hand, in this meeting this week when that was raised, you got some very fiery, powerful kickback. Did you expect that?
I don't think I was at the meeting, and I don't think we got a lot of kickback. I remember one faculty member asking us to explain the actual details of our policy that we wanted to see, and we explained that we were under the impression that the meeting wasn't there for us to present details because that's something that Harvard community as a whole should come up with, setting what this harassment policy would look like.
Well, I don't know. I'm reading fury, firestorm, people saying, whoa, wait a minute, this isn't a path that we can put our feet on.
I heard one professor, maybe two, and one student who actually say that this issue of free speech, believe it or not, probably took up no more than at the most, and Aaron, you can correct me, 15, 20, 30 minutes of the conversation, like talking about actual.
So are we all holding hands here? Are we going to have a speech code at Harvard Law School? How soon? How restrictive?
I don't think it's a speech code, though. Well, a harassment code.
You know, I think it's odd, though, Joshua, that you mention the professor's words in class as being sort of more protected than student speech, because you think that the classroom speech is speech and not speech plus conduct. I'm actually of the view that if we are serious about having a policy, then it may have to restrict teachers more, because the marketplace of ideas, I don't think, works as well in a classroom setting because of the power imbalance. It's difficult to respond to a professor when he says that the blacks have contributed nothing. I mean, but on campus, even the stuffing the heart boxes was responded to vehemently. And if you want to talk about producing a danger of physical violence, well, is that on the part of the listener or the speaker? I mean, who's to determine what goes beyond that line? And that's where chilling speech is a factor.
But I think we can come up. I don't think I'm trying to say professors' language is more protected, because I was just using that because that was the example we had in the classroom. But I think that we can come up and say there's certain conduct which might include speech components, but conduct that is not acceptable. We do it all the time.
Joshua, Aaron, Nels, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. We're talking about free speech on campus, in this case at Harvard Law School. It's a rarefied environment, but what gets done, what gets decided, examples that get set there can trickle out to the entire society. Should we be drawing lines around speech, around harassment? Can you draw a line around harassment without drawing lines around speech? Where should free speech lie? Marlon's on the line. Hi, Marlon. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just want to say that we live in a society, a civilized society, and it is rather unfortunate that we cannot really distinguish what is a free speech and what is commendable free speech and what is damaging to First Amendment. For instance, I believe that we should protect freedom of speech, but at the same time, we cannot condone freedom of action, whether it's a speech component or the physical component, that harms somebody's pursuit of happiness.
But how do you have it both ways, Marlon? In protecting people, if we have to prohibit speech, you don't have free speech anymore.
No. You could have free speech.
Yes.
As long as you don't infringe on somebody's happiness, meaning you don't harm somebody. For instance, this gentleman mentioned about stuffing the swastika thing in the mailbox. that is clearly a violation of somebody's freedom of happiness.
Well, clearly.
That mailbox does not belong to the gentleman who stopped the information in the first place.
Marlon, I think you're putting your finger right on it. I want to put it to Nels Peterson. Nels, Marlon says, have your free speech, but don't step on anybody's toes. Can we have it both ways?
Well, I'm not exactly sure where in the Constitution the freedom of happiness is found.
Well, the pursuit is there.
And the Declaration of Independence.
part of our proud legacy. If speech stands in the way, does speech have to give way?
No. The speech is an integral part in order to protect happiness. There's many very difficult things that go into developing a society that can provide you the opportunity to pursue happiness. And free speech is one of those aspects.
Marlon, Nels is not willing to cut short speech to protect somebody's happiness. You're going to live with that?
No. May I interject? Mm-hmm. I want to say that, for instance, let me give you a quick example. For instance, KKK March, right?
Yes.
I think that their freedom of speech, it should be protected. They have, under the Constitution, right to march in a civilized fashion.
As civilized as a KKK march can be.
Yes, but if it infringes on somebody's freedom of the pursuit of happiness by them harming other people or burning cross on somebody's private property, that is clearly damaging somebody's pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we must protect freedom of speech. At the same time, we cannot allow ill-gotten action, whether it's a speech component.
We don't want to see people hurt, and we got that. But yet, when these two clash, when they intersect, there's the rub. John's on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. You know, I don't know that there's any way to protect this sense of happiness, and I don't want to downplay the hurtful nature of inflammatory speech, but I think that if people want to display their ignorance by inciting other people with such inflammatory words, mm-hmm. they've got to be free to do that, and there's just no way that we can limit that without it trampling on the things that make the United States, at least in theory, great.
So, John, you're saying this is the cost of a free society, this is the price of a free society, having some ugly stuff at the edges of that freedom.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just like flag burning. I think, you know, anybody who chooses to do that is doing that, you know, for the purpose of making an absolutely strong statement. I'm not for flag burning myself, but this has got to be such an amazing country that we can protect the people who choose to protest by saying, I'm going to light this flag on fire because I know that it's going to spark a reaction among the masses.
John, stand by. Joshua Bloodworth, you're president of the Black Law Students Association. You may see yourself as the flag being burned. How do you respond to John's view?
I would say that context is everything. We can say free speech needs to be protected, and I'm all for that because I agree with Aaron Katz that you need free ideas, and I think harassment chills speech in the simple fact that it's very interesting that people are talking about, it might offend people. No, we're talking about speech that can really hurt people, and you have to look at the context. The context is that if you are a Native American student walking around campus, given the history of the country, and every time you walk into school, the classroom, someone starts doing their mock of a Indian chant to you and starts doing that when you're talking, that's not only going to chill your speech, but that is really an intentional move to harm you, and given the history of this country, who is to say that that's not going to get physical?
But what about when it's much more subtle than that? I mean, that sounds like something very, a kind of gross, very clear. What about a heated conversation in a classroom over difficult issues? You deal with them all the time in any law school, in any university. And suddenly, someone of whatever race, religion, gender, you name it, is offended by something someone else has said. We're talking here, as I understand it, about a harassment policy with penalties included.
No, with penalties, but I would like to point out that the example that we used about feminist Marxists and the blacks, no one is arguing that that comment would come under this harassment policy. Now, that's why I'm saying people are pointing to this as a free speech code, but we are talking about conduct, and what we are arguing is that there are times when conduct will be speech will be a part of the conduct that's so egregious that it will be contracted. When I was a first year, I had a professor tell me that in black communities, it's a ritual young black men to get put into jail. It's a known fact. I came from a black community. I've never heard that. I thought it was offensive, but no one was saying that he should not hear that. I had another student who wrote in the newspaper said, just like when you would move aside when you see a pit bull coming, you should move aside when you see a group of young black males coming because they're dangerous. Again, I was offended. No one is saying that should not be allowed. But there are certain instances when speech goes so far that and is part of a conduct that it is really intentional, meant to intimidate and harm people. And I don't see what is wrong with punishing that.
John, thanks for your call. Aaron Katz, can you see how that line might be drawn? Can we have it both ways, free speech and yet prohibitions when it's melded with conduct that is menacing, threatening, damaging to a fellow citizen?
Well, I mean, I think my first response to Joshua is that, well, last year people were calling for the professor, actually both of those professors, to step down and stop teaching first-year classes. So, you know, I'm concerned about how a policy would be written or interpreted in the future. I also think that how you're defining speech spilling into conduct is just tied to how offensive you think the speech is. I don't think that stuffing the mailboxes is conduct. I mean, clearly what the thing at issue was the actual flyer, which was totally speech. You know, your first caller had a point that several critical legal theorists have brought up, that when it infringes on something like happiness, it actually chills counter speech, which is bad. But I think it's interesting to note that a policy might actually be giving a stamp of approval to having sort of thin skin. It may even give power to having thin skin. Maybe what we want is for people to have thick skin and to be able to really take the most hot and harsh speech and still be able to respond in spite of it.
The white man says have thick skin. The black man says, this could hurt. Nels Peterson, can you see how to thread this needle?
It's a very difficult needle to thread and has been for the last 200 years. Free speech is a democracy is a difficult project, but I think
such a bright line, or has always seemed to be. You can say what's on your mind, or you can't.
Yeah, and quite frankly, particularly in the academic environment of a law school, which is training you to go out and practice in the adversarial environment, where the people on the other side of the bench, or often the judge, isn't going to be particularly nice to you. I think that having to build some thick skin like that is not necessarily a bad thing.
But the judge isn't likely to throw a swastika at you, isn't likely to attack you on racial grounds.
No, that's right. And I think that those sorts of incidents are incredibly offensive and incredibly out of place. And I think the community has every right to protest those and to indicate its deep censure and disapproval with those, as the community did. And quite frankly, the students who engage in those are not having a very pleasant time on campus right now.
Josh Bloodworth, what do you imagine? How would this be enforced? Would you have some kind of marshal sitting in a classroom in the hallways, a kind of a tisk-tisk brigade or an honor system, or how would it work?
I would assume that it would work much like the sexual harassment policy, where if a student made a complaint, there would be a review. It doesn't need to be made private, public, by the admin board is what we call that on the university. And then given the context and what happened, if the admin board felt that they had engaged in discriminatory harassment, they would be sanctioned just like a sexual harassment policy. And I just wanted to mention that it is easy to say when you're not in the minority to say, oh, yeah, just toughen up. In the real world, people will sometimes be trouble for your black.
Toughen up. That's going to happen. Toughen up. We're talking about free speech on campus tonight with Harvard Law School students. We've got an example going on right there, but it's not just a Harvard question. It's right across the country. Can we protect speech and people? Free speech and free people. This debate's been going on for decades now. Why haven't we figured it out? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about free speech on campus. We have a Harvard Law School example. A harassment code is being proposed. Speech is part of that. Some people call it a speech code. Can you have a law school with a speech code? Can you argue all the constitutional issues that go into every nook and cranny of American life and have to worry about how you're saying The words, in a diverse society, will we always be ambivalent about the free speech ideal? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined tonight by Joshua Bloodworth. He is president of the Black Law Students Association, also by Aaron Katz, a second-year student at Harvard Law School, member of the Healthy Diversity, or more recently, the Diversity Committee there, and by Nels Peterson. He's executive member of the Harvard Federalist Society. Nels, you wanted to speak to this analogy to sexual harassment. Can we treat harassment more generally, speech in particular, along the same lines that we've come to understand how to treat sexual harassment?
I don't think they're analogous. The Harvard Law School sexual harassment policy applies directly to physical relationships between professors and students, particularly professors who are in a grading relationship with the students. It also
not to talking dirty.
It covers some talking dirty, but generally there's a physical implication with this speech. Like, it directly covers propositioning mm-hmm. students, mm-hmm. things like mm-hmm. that. And I think the physical conduct nature of the sexual harassment policy makes it not directly analogous to this situation.
Harassment does not require physical contact. We all understand that. A more general notion of harassment, you're saying it can't be as neatly defined and understood and identified as sexual harassment?
I think that it's definitely much more of a gray area and more subjective as well.
Josh Bloodworth, how about it? Where does this take us? Can we define it cleanly and clearly enough? The speech component of
I find it interesting that a policy that would cover apparently half the white population, we can find that line. But in a policy that would not cover the white population, and there might be, this might just be the opposite, but what is it about our society that allows us to see it in that instance?
Right, it gets murky there.
Especially since we're talking about speech and conduct together, which is what this policy is talking about.
I want to get a female voice in here from Harvard Law School, not in the studio tonight, but with us by telephone is Joy Cheney. She's a third-year student at the school, member also of the Black Law Students Association, a founding member of the Harvard chapter of the American Constitution Society. Good evening and welcome, Joy Cheney.
Good evening. I'm also a member of the Diversity Committee as well.
Great. It's great to have you. I hope you've been listening in a little bit, Joy.
I have. Yes.
Okay. What do you hear? You see the debate. We've all got it. Thin skin, thick skin, tough speech that hurts. Is there a way to limit it without damaging a constitutional guarantee?
Well, with all due respect, I don't think you have it at all. It's not about thin skin and thick skin. It's really not about that. It's not about black skin or white skin.
Okay.
It's about there being, and it's really not about plain speech. It's about harassing behavior, not just being offensive or speaking your mind. No mm-hmm. one is trying to limit that. And first of all, I'd like to first say I think this conversation is a bit premature because the Diversity Committee is only in the process of thinking about and researching the need, if there is one at all, of the policy.
Granted, we should note that. And it hasn't been fully drafted yet. It hasn't been put before anybody yet. And it may not ever be accepted. But we couldn't help note, how the hair stood up on the back of the school's neck right away. And that's what's got our attention.
It has gotten your attention. But I think the fact that you're saying that there's something wrong with limiting really racial epithets.
Well, I don't know. I'm asking. You tell me.
That's what we're saying. We're not saying that you shouldn't be able to speak your mind in class. I'm certainly not saying that. Let me not say we. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not saying that. What I'm saying is there is some speech that isn't protected by the United States Constitution. The law school is not separate from the rest of society. Simply because you're in law school, I know there was some discussion of should we be doing this in law school. Mm. Simply because you're in a law school environment doesn't mean that you are
exempt from reality,
exempt
from pain,
reality.
From the rest.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that there is some behavior that is absolutely harmful and that chills more speech than it does encourage it, and that's what we're aiming at.
But Joy, I wonder if you can really boil it down to something as relatively clear and simple as racial epithets. There are many ways to wound and wound deeply without actually using a racial epithet.
Absolutely, but we're not. There are certain things that our Constitution and that case law has, and I can't list those things all for you mm-hmm. tonight. I'm mm-hmm. sure none of the gentlemen can. But there are certain things that are not covered in that way, and that's what I would be looking for a code to regulate. For instance, mm-hmm. putting flyers in a person's box with a swastika on it backwards, I might add. And saying things like, well, I won't repeat that this evening, but you all know what I'm talking about. Those things are not protected and need to be sanctioned at the law school. And there needs to be I would argue that there needs to be a policy that covers that type of speech, not only for the protection of those who are the victims of those, of that kind of behavior, but also for people who want to make speech that might be offensive to one another. We want to provide some kind of, I guess it would say parameters, so that you know what is going to, what is going to now be unprotected speech.
George Cheney, we've got it. Aaron Katz wants to respond.
I mean,
Aaron?
Joy, I mean, you're just absolutely wrong about the flyers not being protected by the First Amendment. You know, the Supreme Court has clearly held that a person can stand on a sidewalk and hand out flyers saying blacks are inferior, calling them by the N-word. That's clearly constitutional. That is constitutional. It was a clear case. This was not a violation of personal property. Anyone can put anything in hark boxes. This was clearly protected speech outside of the law school.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
George Cheney.
That's not true. You can't just put, there are some limits on what you can put at the Harvard Law School hark boxes. They are the property of Harvard Law School.
Well, and there we go, about what you can do within a private setting, and I suppose there is more latitude there. Hang on, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Stephen is on the line. Hi, Stephen, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Right along the lines of what they're talking about right now, she said something about how using racial epithets and hurtful speech causes more silence. It seems to me that's the problem right there. I mean, this is how democracy works. If someone is saying or doing things that are offending a certain group of people, those people have the right to get up and to rebut that in some way. Rather than giving power to the government, in this case the school government, to decide what people can and cannot say through a law, shouldn't the students or the people of a society, in a larger sense, keep the power for themselves to work against those kind of things in their own way through a democratic process.
Grab onto that same First Amendment and push back using it.
Exactly.
Push back with speech.
Exactly.
Josh Bloodworth?
I definitely think that students should fight back, and that's what we're trying to put weapons in our bag to fight back, because it's very interesting to say you are being, and I would really like to see the breakdown about how this offensive speech affects people of color, people who have been oppressed versus those who haven't, and it says it's not that difficult. So you're already being emotionally hurt and silenced, and then you're being told, and then take time off from everything else you have to do and fight back against it while you're being hurt. That's like saying, you know what, you've been beat up, don't go to the authorities, wait to try to fight back while you're being
healed yourself.
Yeah, you know, heal yourself and fight back at the same time, and don't go to the authorities. But I thought the authorities were there to protect everyone,
including free speech. Nels Peterson.
I agree 100% with the caller. The best response to poor speech is more speech, and I think we saw that this past year. Huge protests just excoriating the people who perpetrated these events. And it's been very clear on campus that the community does not accept what happened. I don't think we have to have more rules.
And yet, we feel the pain is still open. George Cheney, we just got 10 seconds left, but the last word goes to you.
I'd like to say that the committee is really interested in hearing from all students, faculty, and staff at the law school campus. And to be honest with you, we have not determined what exactly we are going to do. But it's absolutely legitimate for a student, individual, or in a group to suggest to the school and ask that the school protect them. That is part of the democratic process. There's nothing wrong with that.
Here we go. You're in the politics of it, and it's a big political stream. Good luck swimming in it. Joy Cheney, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And here in the studio, Aaron Katz, Joshua Bloodworth, Nels Peterson. Thanks to all three of you for coming in from the
thank
law
you.
School.
Good
luck with it. We'll be following with interest over there and on campuses around the country. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, leadership in the boardroom. This is On Point. Over the past year, many business analysts have bemoaned a lack of leadership in American industry. CEO became a four-letter word as the skippers of several large corporations were implicated for questionable accounting practices that defrauded stockholders out of millions of dollars. But the backlash against corporate execs hasn't hit everyone. The recently retired CEO of IBM, Lou Gerstner, has managed to remain one of the nation's most respected business leaders. Gerstner is largely credited with turning Big Blue's fortunes around since he took over the ailing tech giant in 1993. Gerstner spoke about leadership last night at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Here are excerpts from his speech.
I don't believe that the most difficult part of being a leader is giving a sense of direction. Although, obviously, without that, you don't even begin to be a leader. I mean, you've got to tell people, you know, this is what we're going to be. This is where we want to get to. This is our expression of what leadership means. But people don't do what you expect. They do what you inspect. And so the issue of now, how do you take a huge enterprise and make sure that it goes out and executes? Execution is much harder than vision. It's much harder. Getting an institution aligned to do something. There's a lot of agendas inside an organization. Even an organization probably the size of the Kennedy School. And, you know, in an institution like IBM, which is not a classic manager-worker institution, it's 300,000 professionals. I mean, we have more Nobel laureates than most countries. We've won every major physics prize and computer science prize. These are all very smart people who have a very strong view on what ought to be done. And if it isn't what they think ought to be done, then in the old days it didn't get done. So to me, the critical task of a leader in transformation, in changing an institution, is you've got to create a sense of crisis. You have got to create a sense of crisis. No organization is going to change in a fundamental way unless it believes there's real pain staying the way we are. And so I had the benefit of the conditions you described. Mm-hmm. I mean, billions of dollars of losses, cutting the dividend, people being fired for the first time in the history of the company, not by me, but by my predecessor, and then by me. I finally got the IBMers to understand we really need to do something different or we're all in trouble. And to me, that is the sine qua non of transformation. You've got to create that sense of crisis. It's got to be there. I think it's why even our government tends to seem to work better when we're facing a threat from outside. It's a sense of, I got to do something differently, I got to come together, there's an urgency, and I got to give up something. Having created that sense of urgency, then you can go and say, now let's talk about how you execute this strategy, how you execute this vision, how you arrive at this vision.
That was Chairman of the Board and former CEO of IBM, Lou Gerstner, speaking last night at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Kelly, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Sets and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBU.